This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to Godspeed, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual practices in an effort to better understand each other and to help foster tolerance and human unity. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. I am your host, Michael Hellenbeck. When preparing for today's broadcast, I decided to look up the word tolerance in a few dictionaries. And in most cases, I found a definition close to this one. It said, tolerance, noun, as in sympathy or indulgence for beliefs and practices differing from one's own. Well, we all know too well about the wars and conflicts throughout human history that have been fought in the name of religion. Many people today that I talk to wonder if the world's religion and their leaders will ever find the common ground needed to stand side by side in this world peacefully. Yet, in this world, there are vast organizations of religious peoples actively working together to create peace and prosperity. And on today's show, we're going to explore the efforts of religions working together for peace. With us to shed light on this topic and to help us better understand the tremendous effort by religious organizations to work together for peace, we have our guest, Dr. William F. Vindley, Secretary General of Religions for Peace, the largest global coalition of representatives from the world religions dedicated to the enduring mission of stopping war, ending poverty, and protecting the earth. Dr. Vindley is a theologian and holds a doctorate in systematic theology from Fordham University. Since 1994, he has served as Secretary General of Religions for Peace. He is a member of its World Council and serves as the organization's Chief Executive Officer. He oversees the International Secretariat in Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe, and the Middle East, and coordinates the organization's international activities in more than 70 countries worldwide. In areas engaged in armed conflict, Dr. Vindley works to mobilize and equip religious communities to mediate and mitigate violent conflicts and build a climate of peace. And throughout the world, he has led negotiations that have helped to prevent conflicts from developing in the first place and mediate peace among warring parties, as well as rebuilding societies in aftermath of violence. Also under his leadership, Religions for Peace has engaged religious communities throughout Africa to assist orphans of HIV and AIDS. In 2008, he was a participant of His Majesty King Abdullah's historic interreligious meeting in Madrid, Spain, and has been requested by the Muslim World League to serve on its follow-up committee. Furthermore, he is an advisor to the White House through President Barack Obama's Interreligious Dialogue and Cooperation Task Force. Dr. Vindley is also a frequent lecturer in academic, United Nations, and NGO fora, and has been awarded numerous prizes for religion and human rights. Welcome to the show today, Dr. Vindley.
Well, Michael, welcome for me to be here. Thank you for welcoming me. It's a pleasure, and for your very generous introduction. Thank you.
We appreciate you coming on today and taking time to share your significant knowledge, your deep experience, and your firsthand understanding from the front lines of religions working together to make a positive difference. And I'm hoping to start today by asking you if you could tell us about the history of Religions for Peace, and perhaps address questions like, how did this start? Where did the organization come from? How has it developed over the years? Perhaps speak to the core philosophies and values behind the organization. And please feel free to take your time with these questions. Godspeed is not a debating forum. It's rather a space for education, trying to provide tools for people to learn about and better understand the world of religion and spiritual belief systems.
Thank you.
So the floor is yours.
Michael, thank you very much. And to all your listeners, greetings. The origins of Religions for Peace can be traced back quite a ways. I think ultimately they go back to very sensible religious people across time who have experienced the splendor of the divine in their own religion. And their common sense told them, and the eye of mercy, the eye of beauty, the eye of love that they were given through their religious experience saw beauty and love all around. And so there's always been a nagging sense that the beauty I've experienced must in some basic way be present in another faith, even if I don't understand all that.
That's
be.
Interesting, yeah. So how did the organization Religions for Peace take shape?
Well, it goes back to the 1960s, a turbulent period all around the world. And it goes back to movements within religious communities on major continents taking place simultaneously. Here in the United States, there was a United States Conference of Religions for Peace, and it consisted of very eminent American religious leaders. They met at the time of the war in Vietnam in Southeast Asia. They met at the time that civil rights were very dramatically being engaged here in the United States. And some 450 American religious leaders convened in Washington, D.C. They elected among themselves, or they selected, two people and sent them on a mission around the world to see if there would be interest in holding what they thought would be a one-time world conference, using the word conference as a meeting, not as an organizational structure, right? And they found tremendous interest in Europe. The Vatican Council II had taken place. That was a watershed reinterpretation of a very positive orientation of that faith community, actually enjoining its believers to work to preserve all that is good and true in other world religions. There were similar stirrings in the World Council of Churches. When they moved to India, there was the wake of the Gandhian movement in India. And so there were many there who knew Gandhi, had known him in his life, and were convinced that, in their cases, Hinduism, but the other great religions in India, could collaborate and needed to collaborate. And they moved on to many other countries, but into Japan. And there, the bitter experience that led to the disaster of the Second World War that culminated in the country's defeat had invited religious leaders to put under harsh light how religion had been abused, how the people of that country had been abused by the misuse of their religion. And so moving around the world, by 1969, a working committee, quite literally representing different world religions and different continents, was constituted. And they met in India. Actually, it was constituted in 1968. They met in India. They met in Istanbul. They met here in the United States, and in 1970, so that's approaching 40 years ago now, there was a first ever World Conference of Religions for Peace. The Japanese religious communities hosted it in Kyoto, Japan, and religious leaders from 35 countries joined and were able to define, if you will, or to discern, not areas of shared doctrine. They begin with the premise that those are different and that that people ought to be entitled to have their own, if you will, doctrinal understandings of their own religious heritages. Rather, what they did is put in the center of their table the fundamental problems that the human family was facing. And they said, let's find the areas of moral consensus, not theological or doctrinal consensus, but moral consensus. And they were in the midst of the Cold War. The terror of nuclear annihilation was hanging over the entire world. Any mistake at that moment could have been catastrophic, really, for the human family. So, not surprisingly, when they committed themselves to work together for peace, each tradition having its notion of shalom or salam or shanti, profound, organic, holistic notions of harmony that include harmony with the mystery of the divine, they translated that in a very humble way and said, okay, but what are the threats to that? And they began to build a catalog of areas of moral concern that were both deeply held but also widely shared.
Uh-huh.
And that became, if you will, the platform for their collaboration. And before their really quite historic conference was concluded, they recognized that they weren't engaged with a topic that could be handled by a meeting. They decided to build themselves into an organization,
mm-hmm.
an organization that would honestly acknowledge religious difference and yet form itself around a single principle, respect for sincerity of religious difference, and a single purpose, common action for peace.
Mm.
And so that's a very, very simple formula. It's a low bar, if you will. It allows a vast number of very sincere religious people to step over. Do I believe that the other person sincerely believes what they believe, even if I don't agree with it? You know, that's the minimum that it takes to step over this bar.
Mm-hmm.
And am I willing to work with them out of their sincere moral convictions to make common cause, to try to address the most profound sufferings of the human family that are not, can't anymore ever be defined as Hindu problems or Islamic problems or Buddhist problems or Christian problems or Jewish problems or Jain problems. There are problems. They don't know boundaries. There are common problems. So that's the formula that a great deal of very deeply rooted people of extraordinary leadership in their own religious communities and deeply alert to their respective heritages found that was a formula they could agree upon, that this was going to be fully consistent with the authentic practice of being whatever you were going to be, whether you're going to be a Hindu or a Jain or a Jew or a Muslim or a Christian or a Buddhist or any of the other religions, here's a way we could really work together. And, and Michael, in that early period, they did astounding things. They went to the White House together from all corners of the earth, different faces. They were received by Jimmy Carter and other extraordinary people in our own government.
Uh-huh.
But they went to the Kremlin as well. They went to
uh-huh.
China as well. And they went as a group. And they advocated at the highest level for confidence-building measures. This was the Cold War period.
Yeah.
And for measured steps to walk back from the brink of the abyss of nuclear war.
Yes.
So that was the time, and those were the origins. And Michael, if I can, we're here in the United States, I can use an American little metaphor
mm-hmm.
that I think certainly informed the Americans, but was one that was resonant around the world because other traditions had their own metaphors that they could reach out to.
Of course.
But if we think about Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King, there's two images I'm posing here. We think about him in a little church, and he's speaking as a believer to believers of that tradition. So he speaks in the language of that tradition, in terms of its own, to the in terms of the writings that are sacred to it, in terms of the conventions of thought and prayer and so forth. And he does it in a very remarkably creative and contemporary way for the time. He addresses the scandal of racism. Then Dr. King walks out and walks across the street several blocks, and he's out on the Nation's Mall underneath the Washington Monument. And in front of him are 500, maybe 600,000 people, but he can't repeat the sermon he's just given in the church. Because there he was one among fellow believers. He hasn't changed. He's still a religious man. But now he's going to talk to 500 or 600,000 people. He hasn't changed. But his speech changes. He then re-expresses in public language, with public warrants or justifications, the same passionate but ultimately religiously anchored concern, so that it can be heard and appreciated and received by all the people out in front of him, be they Jews or be they Muslims or Hindus or people who don't have religious persuasions. So he, in effect, became bilingual, religiously bilingual. He kept his primary language, which was his, for him, Christianity, but he became able to express its concerns in a public idiom. And that's what happens in Religions for Peace. The religious communities become, in effect, bilingual, and they are able to hold on to their own discourse within their own communities, but then join together in a public way to talk about those common problems and then to take action together.
That is quite a feat, though. But I do. I think that's a wonderful analogy and nice metaphor, and it explains why I, as I'm a citizen of Denmark and I grew up in a Lutheran country, but I do understand what Dr. King was saying. Now, the organization, Religions for Peace, out of those efforts to essentially try and save the world from, I guess, if I understand it right, primarily a nuclear holocaust, relatively shortly after World War II, has, in the years since, transformed, as far as I can see, into a significant organization with multiple levels of activities, both in terms of meetings, dialogues, discussions, but also practical activities around the world where religions, religious people from different religions are helping people and doing the groundwork. Can you talk a little bit about the organization as it has developed and what the organization looks like today?
Well, indeed, Michael, and again, thank you for your question. The here's if we stand back and if we do the wonderful imaginative act of thinking that we're looking down on the earth and seeing it as from afar, we see immediately that already the world is latticed with religious communities. They're everywhere. They exist locally, nationally organized, regionally organized, and often globally organized. So Religions for Peace recognized very early that multi-religious cooperation should engage entire religious communities, not simply the uniquely, and I'm using the word in a non-religious sense really, but the prophetic personalities that go out ahead of the pack a bit. And we had a remarkable group of those people at the birth of Religions for Peace. But basically, the biggest set of social infrastructures ever built by the human family are the religious communities. This is really noticeable when you're in the developing world, because if you go into a small town, there might be a post office, but there'll be literally hundreds of what we would understand as community centers of religious organization, be they mosques, churches, or temples.
Yes.
So Religions for Peace began to say to itself, the religious communities are and have been and will continue to build themselves across time. What we need is connective tissue between the religious communities, exactly where they are.
Uh-huh.
And therefore we set out to build national inter-religious councils,
okay,
led by the leaders of the religious communities in those individual countries. So if you would go to Uganda, you would very quickly discover that this is the sociology of religion in Uganda. These are the communities present, and their leaders are known, and it would be very after you've been working at this for years, and there's an accrued credibility, not difficult to meet each of those leaders and their staff individually, and then to convene them in a joint meeting and invite them to build their own national affiliate of Religions for Peace, which would follow the same principles, be part of a much broader network, and yet have the creativity of self-leadership, which is vital for creativity. And if you would move to the neighboring states, you could do the exact same thing. So what Religions for Peace has done is followed, if you will, the outlines of the way the religious communities have built themselves, from the most local level to the national level. Mm-hmm. We go to Africa, for example. We will find in all African Council of Churches, a Hindu Council of Africa. We'll find the Episcopal Conference of the Roman Catholic of Africa and Madagascar. We'll find Islamic organizations that are pan-African. So you can very intelligently, if you will, in terms of respect for the way the religious communities have built themselves, begin to put together a regional multi-religious council, or a regional Religions for Peace council. Mm-hmm. And in addition, you would go further. You'd say, well, have these communities at national levels, regional levels, even globally, built women of faith organizations?
Okay.
Can they be networked across different religions? What about youth organizations? They're just brilliant in their creativity. Can they be networked around the issues that Religions for Peace is focusing on? So that's how we've proceeded. We now have 6 regional councils in all the major continents, and 70 national councils, but growing at 5 or 8 national councils every year, sometimes faster. Women of faith networks, youth networks, and all of representatives of all these come together every 5 years, together with very senior representation of the world's religious institutions, and elect a World Council of Religions for Peace, 60 persons. And so we're able to have an organ that can function as a global agent of our mission, regional agents and national councils, and even down to the most local level. So that's how this very organic family coalition of Religions for Peace is building around the world.
Uh-huh.
And it is, as your second part of your question noted, it is always action-oriented. And the action is the action needed in that place and at that time, because for religious people, peace is the overarching positive metaphor, taste of reality, and the threats to get to that peace, those things that are holding us back or systematically distorting us from that experience of peace, understood in each religion in its own way, become the areas of common work. So obviously violent conflict is high up on our agenda.
Sure.
We've been very active in that that kind of work. But also, so is extreme poverty. So is so has been the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And a variety of situations in local places are the areas of deeply held and widely shared concern and become the areas that are addressed by religion.
Sure. So basically what you're saying is you're trying to focus on whatever needs to be solved first, but prioritizing, of course, issues of war whenever possible for your organization to address it, as a main priority.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. I'm wondering. There's a question when you were talking about the youth part and the woman's network. One question that popped up in my mind was, how do you address issues of? I mean, you are an organization working with individuals from religions and that are committed to working together. But I think within most religions, there are people and individuals that maybe have differing opinions about, for instance, how should women be engaged and how should young people be engaged. And there's a lot of cultural differences across the world in all these religions. How do you address these things?
Well, your question is a very wonderfully perceptive one, and the answer is both boldly and carefully. And I'll start with the carefully.
Yeah. If
you're a multi-religious organization,
yeah,
you're really not equipped to tell religious communities how they should organize themselves internally. So let me say it in a humorous way. Baptists in Texas really don't have any business telling Tibetans in Tibet or in India how to arrange their religious ceremonies, right?
Yeah.
Or vice versa, right? So
yeah.
That's we make a decision that respectful decision that each religious community is fundamentally responsible for its own ongoing reform according to its own deepest, most original experiences of the dignity of the human being themselves.
Sure.
So that's an ongoing task for every religious community across time. This carefully part of the answer, where we are disciplined, is to say, what's the business of a multi-religious organization? That business is unity around any genuine violence against human beings, or increasingly any disrespect for the environment that sustains us all. So we map out our agenda in the areas that I think are very appropriate to a multi-religious community. And as I use that little phrase, these are consensual areas of deeply held and widely shared concern. Let me give you an example that isn't consensual, and people can disagree very, very profoundly about it.
Yes.
And because they do, it's not a good topic for Religions for Peace. In some societies, abortion is an issue which is very polarizing.
There are
people who religiously oppose it very strongly, and there are people who are religiously more tolerant of that practice.
Uh-huh.
Religions for Peace is not equipped to mediate that kind of moral disagreement. It simply has to say to itself very humbly, we are not equipped. However, what you do find is that you find enormous consensus around major issues: stopping war, addressing extreme poverty, addressing disease pandemics, increasingly caring for the earth. You get almost unanimous agreement that those are moral obligations that are central to central and shared by diverse religious communities. So we patiently, honestly, have to sort through what falls within our own scope of mission and areas that each religious community has to address on its own, maybe indirectly stimulated by good practices of other religious communities that they meet in multi-religious work.
Yeah, so rather than addressing and trying to find consensus about contentious topics, you are addressing, you're gauging the issues that the different religions can agree on, a way to proceed on, and then proceeding with actions to do something.
That's right, and that builds a virtuous cycle. I've been in situations, Michael, for example, immediately after the most recent war in Iraq took place, and there was shock in the country, and there were also very dangerous insecurities among different tribal groups and different religious groups there. So you had to work to find the area that everybody could agree upon.
Okay.
And it won't surprise you that we could find almost immediately agreement on war-injured children.
Okay. Sure.
Whether you were a person of one, I'm talking about an Iraqi person of one perspective or the other, and you might really disagree tremendously with people within your own country, war-injured children you could agree upon. So we began projects precisely on war-injured children, taking them to Korea to have reconstructive surgeries and letting religious leaders bring back, if you will, the fruits of their collaboration to their own communities. Now, in that process, what happens is that you begin to experience the person that you perceived as potentially threatening, and you mm-hmm. successfully work together to help these children. And yeah. as you did that, you didn't just help the children, you helped each other to have an experience of trust, of success, of confidence. And when this works well, the circle widens. You now find, well, actually, we can agree not just on war-injured children, but we can agree on the next level up, say. And you keep patiently trying to widen the circle of area of consensus, of shared concern, and bring home support, real fruits of collaboration. And
yeah.
that actually transforms people who can be terribly polarized, terribly threatened and frightened
yes.
at one another, fundamentally into allies.
Yes. Yes, I was about to say that the simple action of trying to do good and doing good and creating and helping people, even if they might disagree with certain issues, would naturally build trust. And
that's right.
You go from, in the distrust issue, something that we deal a lot with is the balance between people really working together with their brains and versus working together with their hearts.
Right.
And it sounds like you're able to find some common ground and build some trust and help people see each other in a different way than not just their brain is saying we believe this or they believe that, but actually trust each other and start building some real coalitions.
That's right. You've expressed it well.
I've seen your organization grow personally over the last many years, and followed it your activities. Could you explain a little bit about? I know that you meet, and you mentioned it a little bit. I know you have a World Assembly every 5 years.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I believe you had one in 2006.
That's correct, Michael.
Which means the next one would be coming up in 2011?
That's right.
Could you explain what that is and who is participating in that?
Yeah. So I shared at the very beginning of our discussion this first World Assembly. It was really the first World Conference of Religions
sure.
for Peace. And some representatives from some 35 countries came. The most recent one in 2006 involved over 800 religious leaders from over 100 countries, and then very large numbers of local...
800 representatives from over 100 countries.
Yeah, 800 religious leaders. Now, these could be... they're all leaders. They could be the topmost religious leaders in their...
Yes.
in their religious tradition globally, or they could be the leader of a grassroots community. We
sure.
recognize leadership at different levels.
Sure.
And what we would do in a situation like that is we would focus on, we would use that as an extraordinary opportunity to take the pulse of the world, if you will, to go back to that discerning the shape of the contemporary threats to peace, to widen that circle of deeply held and widely shared moral concern, and to try to, in a certain way, build the base of a program of action. We focused it on something that I just give tremendous credit to the religious leaders. We focused it on what they called shared security.
Okay.
And that's an interesting coupling. Security is usually a political term, so we're in what Martin Luther King, in that idiom, we're in that public language form.
Yes.
But security discussions came out of notions of national security, where one nation can secure itself against another nation. And the world community learned that that was a useful but inadequate metaphor for security, because there were many states where people were being hurt within the state.
Yes.
So in the United Nations and in other circles, there was developed a notion of human security, and saying, well, actually, we have to be concerned about the fundamental dignity of human beings within states, wherever they are, the basic rights as human beings. But even that, for the religious community, though a wonderful step forward, doesn't touch what is so elegant and so fundamental to the religious communities, that the notion of reciprocity, that I'm responsible for you, that you're responsible for me, that in practical terms today, none of us are really more secure than the least secure among us, that we simply can't build walls. We can think we have little islands or enclaves of security, but fundamentally we're deluding ourselves. If the world is large numbers of the human population are rendered excessively vulnerable, we're all vulnerable. That's even hard-headed political, I'll call them realists, get that lifeboat metaphor that if there's a hole in one side of the boat still sinks, even if the other side is really sound. But religious people have always known that. They've always recognized at a very profound level that your well-being is linked to my well-being. And that and that's maybe formulated as a golden rule or some metaphor, but it even goes deeper than that. It's the sense of profound care for the other. So what the assembly did, and did it with including former heads of state and current heads of state, so remarkable political representatives there, forged a notion of shared security that echoes, if you will, this deep moral imperative that most religions across time have been able to articulate, that the other's well-being has to be my concern. And did this in a very practical set of metaphors in terms of the big challenges that we all face today, and providing an overarching kind of public language metaphor that at least is resonant with the deepest notions of peace in Christianity and Islam and Judaism and Hinduism, Buddhism, and the other great religions. Now, in addition, Michael, simultaneously, there would be extraordinary working sessions in an assembly. So the religious leaders from Palestine and from Israel would be convened and be given expert facilitation. Religious leaders from the Democratic Republic of Congo, from Somalia, from Sri Lanka, from places of conflict, they would all be at very senior levels in the assembly and being given special sessions within the assembly, private ones, where the accrued wisdom of how religions can engage in conflict transformation could be shared, and they could be equipped to lead that work in their own home states. And we would have representatives of the biggest public NGOs dealing with the big development challenges and the big pandemic challenges of today, developing real partnerships with interreligious councils.
Sure.
So we try to make these assemblies both cutting edge in terms of developing areas of consensus, moral consensus among the world's religious communities, and then pivot real practical ways to equip ourselves to engage, share wisdom, and engage in action on the ground around the world.
Sure. So that sounds wonderful. And we don't hear much about religious leaders of Palestine from getting together and talking about what can we actually solve and what can we agree on in the mainstream media. And it's wonderful that Religions for Peace is doing this type of work. And I'm wondering now. I'm trying to understand. The Religion for Peace is relatively closely affiliated with the United Nations. Is that correct?
Well, Michael, I'm sitting at my desk right now,
okay.
And as I gaze out my window, I am overlooking the United Nations General Assembly. I'm directly across the street.
Okay,
and,
that's pretty close.
we are affiliated to the United Nations,
sure.
As many non-governmental bodies are, that have
sure.
purposes that are aligned with the mission of the United Nations. But we're also independent of it.
Sure.
And the religious leaders who founded Religions for Peace recognized that New York City was the international headquarters of the United Nations and felt that the world's religions both needed a headquarters for collaboration,
sure.
for Religions for Peace, but that there should be a bridge of cooperation that extends across the religious communities and the political communities.
Sure.
That bridge has to respect the different identities of religious bodies from governmental bodies, very different mandates, and even
yeah.
different capacities, but that bridge is extremely important, and so we do have that very strong relationship, and within 5 minutes' walk, I can be in almost any of the embassies that are affiliated to or recognized by the United Nations. So it's extremely helpful for Religions for Peace to be able to work in close tandem, but with its own distinct identity,
sure.
with the largest intergovernmental organization.
Sure. On a little bit on a personal note, I'm wondering if you could share with our audience a little bit about how you got personally involved with this type of work and what led you down this path.
Well, you look back in wonder. All of us do. Each single person does that. It looks back in wonder, how did I arrive here? And yet the wonder also seems to make sense. It would have been hard to have projected, but when you look back, you say, well, I guess I'm where I... where I've come to, and that seems right. My own background was in science, in a field known as molecular biology. I was thinking of doing medicine as well, and yet found as much as I respected and continue to respect science, that it wasn't equipped to ask certain kinds of questions that were very valid questions. Those were the questions that the religions have always been asking. And they're not fundamentally in opposition to scientific inquiry. They're really fundamentally different questions, different kinds
uh-huh.
of questions. So I found myself seized by that. And as a person who was raised in a Christian home and was given that heritage as a background, I was nevertheless intensely curious and was fortunate enough to meet in my university a Japanese Buddhist Zen master who was there
oh,
visiting
okay.
professor of philosophy and So I moved to, I postponed going to medical school and moved to Japan.
Okay.
And practiced meditation for 5 years. And the wonderful help that I received by the Buddhist community actually invited me to understand my own faith heritage at a much deeper level.
Huh.
So it's a story that can sound strange to people, but it is one that is increasingly less strange, and that is that a deep and sincere encounter with another religion that was not one's own actually serves to invite one to reflect far more profoundly on one's own religious heritage.
Yes.
In my case, I wanted to do that with a certain amount of vigor, so I ended up doing graduate studies in theology. But those were immensely enriched by the questions that arose from a very sincere encounter with a different tradition.
Sure.
From there, Michael, I was a professor. I was a dean of graduate schools of theology. And then in the very late 80s, I was introduced to Religions for Peace,
sure.
And I made a decision in 1992, so some years ago, to make this my full-time work, and so I've enjoyed it immensely since then.
Well, it sounds like a profound and very deep and rewarding, and also very challenging piece of work that you are doing with the Religion for Peace. It must be for everybody involved in it.
Well, you just said it very well. It's very little my work. I have the great pleasure of being at the nexus of the collaboration of so many sincere people, honoring their own particular religious heritage. I don't represent Christianity. I am a Christian. That's my heritage. But my job is to there's no conflict with my faith, but to represent those areas of deeply held and widely shared concern about which we collaborate.
Well, we're coming up on the end of our time, but I want to thank you very deeply, Dr. Vendley, for taking the time and giving so generously of your time and speaking with us today. Before we end, can you tell us how people can learn more about your organization? What is the best way for people to learn more and possibly find ways to get involved with the work that you're doing?
Michael, if people will go to, all one word, religionsforpeace.org, we'd love to welcome them at our website and to begin a dialogue and possible ways of collaborating. So this is the world's work. The majority of the human family is religiously affiliated, and seized, inspired, and so this is humble work for all of us, and we'd be delighted to hear from any of your listeners.
Okay, that's religionsforpeace.org.
That's right.
Thank you very much for being with us today, Dr. Vendley. It is now time for us to take a short break, but please stay with us after the break. We will be back, and we will also open the phone lines. The call-in number is 888-873-4643. We'll be back in a second.
Okay, we do have a few minutes left of the program today, and I would like to take that time to share about a significant development in the relationship between Christians and Muslims that have taken place in Europe over the last week. Some of you may know that a certain Danish paper in 2005 printed a cartoon strip depicting the Prophet Muhammad in a manner so insulting to many Muslims that thousands of Muslims literally took to the streets around the world in many countries in violent protests and even ended up burning down both the Danish and the Norwegian embassies in Damascus, Syria in 2006. Well, as late as a few months ago, the cartoonist himself was attacked in his home with an axe-wielding Muslim man wanting to kill him, who broke into his home in front of his 5-year-old granddaughter and tried to kill the man for the cartoons that he had done. Now, last week, in a surprising and controversial move, the Danish newspaper that had printed the cartoons issued an official apology to the family of the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad and indeed the entire Muslim world. And while the entire political establishment, politicians left and right of all sides of the spectrum in Europe and all over the world, including the Prime Minister of Denmark, sharply condemned the newspapers for, in their words, destroying free speech, the following statement has prompted the lawyers of the family of the Prophet Muhammad to announce that the issue is, in fact, settled. And I'm just going to read the statement here as it is. It says, as part of Politiken, which is the name of the newspaper's news coverage of Mr. Kurt Vestergaard's cartoon drawing of the Prophet Muhammad, first published in Danish newspaper in September 2005, Politiken reprinted the cartoon drawing. Politiken has never intended to reprint the cartoon drawing as a statement of editorial opinion or values, but merely as a part of the newspaper's news coverage. It has never been Politiken's intention to offend Muslims in Denmark or elsewhere with the reprinting of the cartoon drawing. However, Politiken recognizes and deplores that our reprinting of the cartoon drawings of the Prophet Muhammad has offended Muslims in Denmark and in other countries around the world. We apologize to anyone who was offended by our decision to reprint the cartoon drawing. That was a statement by the newspaper who originally posted the cartoons that led to the violent protests around the world and the assassination attempts on the humorous cartoonist Kurt Vestergaard. Now, while it's raining down on criticism on the newspaper, the joint press statement was released a few days later from the editor-in-chief of the newspaper and the attorney on behalf of the descendants of the family of the Prophet Muhammad. And I'm just going to read this statement. It says, the Danish national daily newspaper Politiken and its directors of 8 organizations in Egypt, Libya, Qatar, Australia, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, and Palestine that have 94,923 members who are descendants of the Prophet Muhammad have reached an understanding and settlement in the dispute between the organizations and Politiken that arose out of Politiken's reprinting of the cartoon drawing of Prophet Muhammad created by Mr. Kurt Vestergaard and originally published in the newspaper on September 30th, 2005. These drawings, and in particular Mr. Vestergaard's cartoon drawings, gave rise to civil unrest and demonstrations in many countries across the world, and in particular in Arab and Islamic countries where the cartoon drawing was perceived as being defamatory of Islam and specifically of the Prophet. Politiken reprinted Mr. Vestergaard's cartoon drawing as part of the newspaper's news coverage and has never intended to offend Muslims in Denmark everywhere. In a statement that is to be printed in Politiken's print and online edition, Politiken recognizes and deplores that the reprinting of the cartoon drawings offended Muslims in Denmark and in other countries around the world, and apologizes to anyone who was offended by the reprinting of the cartoon drawings. The organizations representing the families of Saudi Arabia confirms that the dispute is settled and agree not to pursue any legal or administrative actions against Politiken. Both parties express their satisfaction with this amicable understanding and settlement, and express that hope that it may in some degree contribute to diffusing the present tense situations. Both parties express their hope and conviction that the agreement may help improve the relationship between the Muslim world and Denmark, and in particular the Danish media, and hope that other acts of dialogue and reconciliation may follow. And with that, we have come to the end of today's show. Thank you for joining us for Godspeed today on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Hallenbeck. Our guest today was Dr. William Vindley of the organization Religions for Peace. For more information on Religions for Peace, you can visit www.religionsforpeace.org. Our engineer today was John Calabro in our New York studio of the Progressive Radio Network. For more information, please visit www.godspeedinstitute.com. We'll be back next Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for another spiritual journey. Until then, Godspeed.